Well, thank you very much indeed, Mr. O'Dowd, Bishop Kevin, Dr. Justin Harkin. Thank you very much for inviting me here. He left nothing out in that introduction, except that I'm only from up the road. grew up on a farm and helped my father, who's 88, block off the donkeys from the hay last week. So I hope I haven't completely lost the run of myself. It's a great honour to be with you here this morning, and I'm very grateful for the invitation. On an occasion like this, a Dominican, Father Timothy Radcliffe, gave a talk, and it didn't go down very well with people. And on the way out, he stopped to ask somebody, he said, you didn't seem to enjoy that talk. And the man said, no, I didn't. But it isn't you I blame, it's those who invited you I blame. So, you know who to blame. It's wonderful to be gathered here this morning to reflect on the impact Pope Francis is making on our church and the invitation he has given to us to revitalize our church, to renew our church. And I have the privileged opportunity just to work with you on this for a couple of hours this morning. As we sit here this morning, another synod is happening in Rome. It's coming to a conclusion today. And just as we sit here this morning, bishops from all over the world are voting on a document that will guide the church over the next while, certainly until the next synod in a year's time, on very important issues relating to marriage and the family. So I hope we feel a sense of being united with them in prayerful discernment. The Holy Spirit hopefully is there. The Holy Spirit is here with us as well. And I would say that what we're doing here this morning is every bit as important in terms of the future of the church, certainly for the Church of Elphin. But anyway, just to, before we kick off, I have a slideshow. The way this will work is I'm going to present a little bit on Pope Francis for about 40 minutes or so. And then we'll have time for some questions and some discussion. Before we start, I'm absolutely delighted to see some younger members of the diocese here with us. And I want to find out what they know about Pope Francis already. Are you going to tell us? What do you know about Pope Francis? Well, first of all, tell us your name.
Amber Kavanagh.
And where are you from?
I am from Friendsburg.
Oh, very good, Friendsburg. And tell us, what do you know about Pope Francis already? Well, can you pick? Is there a picture of him in the room?
Yeah.
Where is it? Okay. Is that the man with the? Yeah. What do you know? What country he comes from?
Is it?
Our little brother's got to give her a hand here. Big brother. Big brother. Oh, sorry. Oops. Oops. What's your name?
Nathan.
Where does he come from?
Spain.
Well, you're almost right. He speaks Spanish. That's his language, all right? But he actually comes from the other part of the world, from Argentina. But anyway, we're delighted you're with us this morning. It's great to have you with us. And I'm not going to go and see who's at the other end of the age spectrum. We leave that one for now. But there you go. I'm going to stand up in the middle of the room here because I think it's easier for people to interact, you know, to follow me a little bit. I'll stand on the border between the business class and the economy, whichever way you want to put it. And you've got two screens here, so in terms of reading the writing, it might be easier for you to follow this screen here, but the same material will be displayed on both screens. There's also a handout which has some of the key points, okay? There's a handout. I think there's one for everyone in the audience. Would that be right, Justin? Yeah? There's a handout for everybody with some of the key points or key quotations that we'll be using. So that'll be given out to you at some stage, okay? So let me just begin by telling you a little bit about Pope Francis and why I think he's so significant in the life of the church at the moment. Really what we're experiencing, perhaps for the first time ever, and I know we always are a little hesitant to say something is happening for the first time ever, but maybe for the first time ever, we're experiencing that we're really part of a worldwide church. Because we live in Europe, and I know we're on the edge of Europe, but we are part of Europe, we may be misunderstanding just how European the church has been. For the past 1,400 years, it has been led by European popes. Most of those working in the Vatican have been Europeans. Most of the cardinals voting for popes have been Europeans. We've lived in what we might call a Eurocentric church. And I think what we're experiencing maybe for the first time, part of what's new, what I'm calling the new normal, because I think it is going to become the normal, is that we are part of a global church. And you know, this is fantastic for us to recognize this because we've fantastic gifts to bring to the whole issue of globalization if we really lived out our faith as a global church and worked together as the largest religious body in the world. So the first thing I think we're coming to terms with is we have a Pope who comes from outside of Europe. Our friends from Fernsberg are partly right in that he grew up, his parents were Italian, but they immigrated and he was born in Argentina, Pope Francis. He speaks Italian fluently, but Spanish would be his native language. He doesn't have a lot of English. He doesn't speak English fluently. He speaks a little bit of German because he studied there for a short period of time. But we're dealing with the fact that we have a Pope who comes from a different perspective. So just to give an example of how different that is, and you'll find the video of this on YouTube, but when he came back from World Youth Day last year, he went to one of the best basilicas, one of the most important basilicas in our church, St. Mary Major's. And he processed up the aisle of this with all the cardinals and all the monsignors and everybody else behind him. And what had he in his hand? A blown up beach ball in the Brazilian colours, and a T-shirt from the Brazilian football team. And he walked up and he put them on the altar beside the tabernacle in St. Mary Major's. Now, if ever we needed a signal that this is a different Pope, that was one. And actually, if you watch the video, the beach ball goes to roll away. It's light, it's full of air, and he pushes it back and he puts the T-shirt around it to keep it in place. I think there's a symbol in that that's something we see this new. So we have a non-European Pope, and we have a Pope who comes what we call the Global South. What do we mean by this Global South? We mean from the parts of the world below in the southern hemisphere, below the equator. And in shorthand, I'm going to show you a lot of slides in a few moments, and don't be too worried if you don't take it all in. As I say, there is a handout, but that's not the most important thing. In shorthand, most of our brother and sister Catholics live in poor conditions on the edges of cities with inadequate health and inadequate access to education, and among the poorest and the least looked after, perhaps, are women. That is the context out of which Pope Francis comes, and it explains an awful lot to us about what are his priorities. You know the saying, it's kind of become a common saying now, it's not all about you. Well, when we're reading Evangelii Gaudium, at one level we have to realize this isn't all about us. In fact, in Europe we're kind of an exception. I know we've our own kinds of discrimination and poverty and exclusion, but on a global perspective, Pope Francis is coming from a place where there are widespread numbers of people who are simply discarded. He actually uses the word discarded in the message he gave us last Lent. He talks about the different ways people can be discarded, spiritually, morally, in terms of economic resources and so on. And he's concerned about those who are discarded, those who are thrown away. He talks about a throwaway culture. Very interesting, for example, I was at World Youth Day in Brazil, and he spoke to the young people a lot about the care for the elderly and the value of the elderly, and that elderly people should not simply be discarded or thrown away. So we're dealing with a Pope who's coming out of this experience. Let me just because I have them on the slides, just show you. This column here says 1950, and this column here says 2000. In the last half century, we've seen a massive shift in terms of where the Catholic population in the world lies. So in Europe, in 1950, 49% of the world's Catholics were in Europe. Today, only 27% of the world's Catholics are in Europe. It's almost half halved. So only one in four, approximately, of the world's Catholics are in Europe. The big growth areas have been in Africa, an increase by 700%, and in Latin America, a increase of up by almost 300%. So now, and I know statistics are hard to follow, but just stay with me for a moment. The most important thing here to realize is that over half the world's Catholics live in Africa and in Latin America. Does that surprise you? No. But it's important to realize it, that this is this is what Pope Francis is very conscious of and what Pope Francis is drawing to our attention. So 708% increase in the churches in Africa. And if you were following, I don't know how much of it reached the ordinary media, but at the Synod in Rome that's been going on this week, in the last 72 hours or so, one of the big realizations is, in fact, the importance of the African church. And there's been a bit of a clash between what the African bishops have had to say about the family and what needs to be in the church's teaching on the family and what some of the European bishops have been saying. And the headlines have been that the African church has come of age. One journalist, John Allen, he's very well known, wrote a column yesterday in which he said, the Africans are no longer the junior partners in the church. He tends to speak in that kind of language, but they're no longer the junior partners. So this is the context out of which Pope Francis is coming. I won't delay, I think, on these particular ones here. Whoever's working the slides for me down here has fallen behind a bit. Technology has let you. You might need to get a bit closer to it. Okay, so we'll just move on. I mean, the main thing to show is that actually, while the Catholic population, you know, again, you often may hear otherwise, the Catholic population has grown from about 654 million in 1970 to 1.2 billion in 2010. Catholic population has increased dramatically. But also, so has the world's population. We've remained a constant percentage of the world's population of about a fifth. So about a fifth of the world's population are Catholics. Not Christians now, but Catholics. And half the world's Catholics are to be found now in Africa and Latin America, and in Europe, just over a quarter. Okay, so that just gives us that global perspective. Pope Francis is the pontiff, the leader of the whole church for the whole world. And for the first time, a non-European in Rome, who's very much, that's his context. That's where he comes from. Okay, so let me continue on. So I'm suggesting to you, and I'm not just the only one suggesting this, we're in a new epoch in the church. Now, Vatican II, the council that took place 50 years ago, that was the first council at which there really were bishops from all over the world. At the previous councils of that, Vatican I, when you had bishops from all over the world, many of them were missionaries. They were from Europe, working in African countries, but they were Europeans. So Vatican I was predominantly European bishops. Vatican II really was a council of bishops from all over the world. But it took maybe these 50 years now for that really, really to sink in and the church to become a global church with the appointment of a first non-European pope. So that's the first kind of main point I wanted to make to you today. Sorry, can I just pause for a moment? We're not only in an era of the global church, but of global communications. And I hear the odd beep of mobile phones. Could you check if your weapon of mass disruption has been turned off? Okay? It might be no harm, just at this point. It'll save you embarrassment later. Thank you. Okay. Now, we all have our heroes, and we all have our influences, and we all have, I suppose, the people who have biggest impact on us. I think it's widely recognized there are many influences on Pope Francis, many Jesuit influences, the main obviously being St. Ignatius and maybe St. Peter Faber, another Jesuit and co-founder of the Jesuits, that Pope Francis actually made a saint within record time of becoming Pope. He did it very quietly around Christmas time, his first Christmas. He called in the head of the Congregation for Saints and said, by the way, Peter Faber, we're naming him a saint. There's a process for that. It's not just the normal process. There's a handout just needed in there. So don't worry, we'll get to everybody anyway. So you've got influences. We all have them in our lives. Pope Paul VI seems to have been a big influence on Pope Francis. So much so, in fact, that he's beatifying him tomorrow. Have I got that right? Yes, it's tomorrow. He's beatifying him. And one of the key documents that Pope Paul VI put out 10 years after the closing of the council was called Evangelii Nuntiandi, announcing the gospel. 1975, Pope Paul VI. One of the key documents. That document has had a huge impact on Pope Francis. In fact, Pope Francis said of this document, he called it the basic point of reference which remains relevant, to my mind, the greatest pastoral document that has ever been written to this day. He actually said that last year about Evangelii Nuntiandi. So if you want to understand Pope Francis, and I know many of you are working in parish groups, to reread Evangelii Nuntiandi might not be a bad idea, to understand where he's coming from. And in Latin America, in the Church of Latin America, that document became hugely important, maybe even more important than in Europe, and had a huge influence on Pope Francis. Remember, Pope Francis was a diocesan bishop until he became pope. So he was working in a diocese among the poorest of the poor on the peripheries of Buenos Aires, and he was leading the process of renewal and evangelization in his own diocese. So Evangelii Nuntiandi, huge influence on Pope Francis. Okay, we're just trying to get a sense of the man who's now leading our church. Okay, a second huge influence on Pope Francis is a process called aparecida. Aparecida is like knock in Brazil. Okay, it's their knock. It's their huge Marian shrine. And again, I was fortunate enough to be there last year at World Youth Day. On the way to World Youth Day, I visited Aparecida. There was a major conference of the Latin American bishops in 2007, talking about bishops from all over the world. Okay, all over the Latin American world, I should say, in 2007. It was a follow-up to a previous conference. And they issued a document which was kind of the landscape document for the future of the Latin American church. And Pope Francis was the main author of that document, along with an Argentinian priest called Victor Fernandez. Why do I mention the man by name? Well, Victor Fernandez, 2 months after Pope Francis became pope, he made him an archbishop. He looks after his friends. While he left him rector of the university in Argentina. But he also made him work for his... So he's now the secretary writing the message coming out of this synod today. He's had a very busy few days, Victor Fernandez. But he's the man who wrote the document of Aparecida. And the document that came out of Aparecida has huge similarities to Pope Francis's first document, the one we call the Joy of the Gospel, or Evangelii Gaudium, which is part of what we'll be looking at today. So, in a sense, people are saying what Pope Francis has done is he's taken what came out of the Latin American church, and, you know, again, there were huge divisions and huge turmoil among bishops in Latin America, different views on liberation theology, different views on popular piety and so on. And he's held all this together in this document. And people are saying that's exactly what he's trying to do now with the world church, is hold the various tensions, acknowledge them, not pretend that they're not there, but bring them together in a way. So anyway, I'm just sketching for you, again, the influences on the man. We said he's not European. He's from the global south. He's very conscious of the world church. He's very influenced by Pope Paul VI's ministry. He's beatifying him tomorrow. He's very influenced by Evangelii Nuntiandi, one of the Pope Paul VI documents. Very influenced by this whole process of Aparecida. And again, we can't delay in that. I'm just opening up. These are like avenues. If you're driving from here back to Chum, you'll see side roads you can't go down. I'm just identifying them and naming them. Okay. So where is there kind of clear continuity between Pope Francis and what has gone before us in terms of evangelization? Where is there continuity with Pope John Paul II, with Pope Benedict and so on? Well, very clearly, that at the heart of evangelization, by evangelization, spreading the gospel, renewing the church, at the heart of it is not a document, is not a theory, is not teachings, even though we might think they're at the core of it. They're not, actually. At the heart of it is a person and a personal relationship, and that person is Jesus Christ. Now, that's the clear message of the church. We could say all down through its history. Clearly the message of the church of Vatican II, clearly the message of Pope Francis, Pope Benedict, Pope John Paul, Pope Paul VI. Evangelization is about enabling people to encounter in a way that really touches them, touches the core of their being, to encounter the person of Jesus Christ. That's what we're about. That's our goal. That's what the church is about. That's the reason why the church exists, is to enable people to experience the person of Jesus Christ. So Pope Francis, along with his predecessors, let's not lose sight of that. It's a personal encounter. Heart meeting heart. That's what we're about. Again, in terms of evangelization, Pope John Paul II in particular was very clear that evangelization is evangelizing a whole culture, that we're all subject to various movements in our society, and our faith cannot be simply a private thing. It can't be just something that's just between me and my God, even though it is obviously between me and my God, but not just. That we live and breathe in a culture and in a society. And that needs to be evangelized. That needs to be converted. There's no, contrary to what some of our politicians might tell us today, there's no neutral context we can all live in. And you get on with doing what you're doing, and I'll get on with doing what I'm doing, and I'll mind my business, and you mind your business. There's no neutral society. Society always has values. I tell this to my students all the time, for example, about ethos in schools. You know, there's a huge movement today saying, oh, we won't have any ethos in our schools. We'll kind of keep it as a, you know, an even play. Everybody can feel welcome, but we won't have any particular. But that is an ethos. that is a particular value system. To claim that there's no value system is your claim. There's always an ethos. There's always a value. We're always breathing some common air, looking through certain common lenses. And so it's not just when we're talking about evangelization, we're not just calling individuals to encounter the person of Christ, we're calling cultures to encounter the person of Christ as well. We're saying we have a particular perspective on how human beings should relate to one another and the values that should inform that kind of what we call the public square or the public space. So that's also, I think, a very common continuity, if you like, with regard to Pope Francis and his predecessors in his understanding of evangelization. And the third point, and again, very much emphasized by Pope Francis, I could mention many more, but you know, we don't have an all day for this. The third point I would pick out is that evangelization is simply what the church does. It's not that we decide, oh, we get up this morning and sure, maybe we'll do a bit of evangelization for a change. That's not, the church exists to evangelize, to be missionary as a church. And Pope Francis actually prefers the word mission to evangelization, I think. But to be missionary, to be out there inviting others, sharing with them our joy, sharing with them what gives us comfort and confidence and a sense of being loved in our daily lives is not an optional extra for a Christian. It's not something we decide, ah, sure, I might do that for a while, see how I get on. But I've done my bit and I get on with something else. To be a Christian, to be a baptized Christian, is to live one's faith. But living one's faith, constitutive of that, part and parcel of that, is to see yourself as a missionary. Missionary is no longer something other people do. Do you remember we used to have the language of the parish mission? Maybe we still have it. And people come on mission and so on. Or we talk about the missionaries who come home or the missionaries who go away. In a way, that language is no longer appropriate. We are all to be missionaries in our context. And, you know, this isn't something you might say, oh, well, that's all right for the 20-year-olds or the 30-year-olds. This is actually for all of us in our own situation of life, whatever that may be, with the particular gifts we have, the particular talents we have, the limitations we have. Some of the most extraordinary missionaries of the church never left their cell, be that a prison cell or a monastic cell, but they still exercised a missionary gift at the heart of the church. So anyway, this is just in terms of what's there still and always there with, you know, over the last few decades in evangelization, signs of continuity. I don't want to overstress this one, but in terms of a sign of possible discontinuity, in other words, maybe a shift of emphasis between Pope Benedict and Pope Francis, is that Pope Francis doesn't seem to want us to hang around to get our act together as a church. I think with Pope Benedict, there was more of a sense of we need to get our own house in order as a church. His emphasis was very much on, in a sense, on the renewal of the church from within and the renewal of the commissioned Christians. The focus of what was called the new evangelization, which emerged maybe with Pope John Paul and then into Pope Benedict. This was kind of a technical term. The focus was on non-practicing Catholics. How do we get non-practicing Catholics back into the church, back fully alive, fully living out their baptismal commitment? That was the focus of the new evangelization. And that was, Mr. Dowd mentioned, I was at the last synod. That was very much what that synod was about. That was the focus of it. Not just in Europe, obviously it's particularly a European issue, but also in other continents. Pope Francis doesn't seem to be as focused on that. He says, wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever state you're in, insofar as you're in a relationship of any kind with Jesus Christ, you're meant to be evangelizing. And let's get on with it. Rather than see the church as we, this is a famous image of Pope Francis, it probably comes up later on my slides, rather than see the church as some kind of perfect house that we only go into when we're kind of reached a level of perfection ourselves, he gives us the image of the field hospital. And he talks about, you know, being out there in the field hospital. In a field hospital, you have to get down and dirty, you make do with what you've got. I remember visiting a field hospital in the bush in Nigeria one time. Many of you, I'm sure, have been missionaries. I see lots of sisters here have probably seen that. Where you know, it's. Let's put it this way. It's more MASH. Do you remember the series MASH? It's more MASH than the Beacon Hospital. All right? So what Pope Francis is saying to us is the church is more MASH than the Black Rock Clinic. Okay? The Black Rock Clinic is grand for those who can afford it, but we all need to have access to the field hospital. In whatever state we're in, and get out there. So there's less on waiting, as I put it here, for the church to get its own house in order. In fact, I think Pope Francis is saying to us, by the very fact of going out there, of leaving what he calls our comfort zones, getting out there, being missionary, speaking openly, confidently about Jesus Christ, knowing how fragile our own faith is, but trusting in God's mercy, and that's one of the things we're going to have to come back on. We will actually get our own house in order. We will recover ourselves as church. But it's not something we do first before we go out. Do you kind of get that point? I think that's a shift of emphasis a little bit with Pope Francis. We have to kind of make do. In a way, actually, if you read Evangelii Gaudium, Pope Francis, of course, is a disciple of St. Ignatius, the founder of the Jesuits. And St. Ignatius was a soldier. And a lot of the language Pope Francis uses is kind of battle language. He talks a lot about soldiers. For example, one place in it he says, I prefer to be a private in a platoon that keeps on fighting than a general of a defeated army who boasts about the battles he lost. You know, he says something like that in one place. And he talks about you know, this idea of that we're constantly involved in a kind of a struggle, a fight. He talks a lot about struggling with evil, struggling with the devil. The language of battle, of combat. And so when you're in a battle situation, you're kind of in an emergency situation. An emergency powers apply. Do you remember we used to have what was called the Emergency Powers Act in the North? Wasn't that right? So it gave an excuse for all sorts of maybe awful things to happen, but it allows for immediate response to particular situations. Now, what Pope Francis really is saying to us is we're kind of in an emergency situation as church, you know? And again, the image of the field hospital, he says, there's no point in asking somebody who's just, you know, who's seriously wounded, well, how's your cholesterol levels? He actually says that in Evangelii Gaudium, you know? Or, you know, how's your blood pressure, you know? He uses that image. I mean, his language is very down to earth, you know? He talks about not becoming, by the way, just another one of his famous phrases. He says, avoid becoming what he calls querulous and pessimistic sourpusses. Looking like you've just come from a funeral, okay? That's the kind of language he uses. He says you won't evangelize anybody if you're going around like that. But this idea that we're in an emergency situation, and the emergency is the mission of the church, and that means we prioritize certain things, and other things we let go of for the moment. And that's a key, by the way, to understanding why maybe he's emphasizing certain things and leaving other things a little bit on the back burner that people mightn't be as happy about as they would like to hear more on, but he's saying, let's concentrate on the core for the moment. Anyway, that's kind of giving you a sense of where he's at. So I think it's less about waiting for the church to get its own act in order. So what's his approach? Now, Evangelii Gaudium, The Joy of the Gospel, was published last year. It's his first... No, technically he's put out two documents. One is called Lumen Fidei, But really, it was already in the pipeline while Pope Benedict was still in office. And while it's got Pope Francis' name, it's not clearly Pope Francis' own document. Evangelii Gaudium is apostolic exhortation, and it kind of comes out of, to exhort somebody is to encourage somebody, to give them a sort of a pep up, an encouragement, and so on. And after every synod, popes issue these exhortations. Now, in actual fact, it's quite clear from doing a bit of background work, he wrote this. This is his own work. It's his own work, along with perhaps this Archbishop Fernandez. You know, obviously a pope has so many things to do, it's perfectly acceptable that you have somebody working with him on it. But what I'm saying is, it's more his own work than simply what came out of the synod. You can see certain reflections from the synod in it, but it's definitely his own work. And if you want to understand Pope Francis, that's not a bad place to start. In fact, it's the key place to start. He's given some interviews as well. Now, it's a long document, and it's not the most readable. Do you remember, was it Oscar Wilde? And I think it's a Blaise Pascal originally that said, you know, sorry, I hadn't time to write you a shorter letter. You know, it takes more time to write a shorter letter, doesn't it? Well, that could be true of Evangelii Gaudium. The Pope was in a hurry. He's made this quite clear. He realizes his time is limited. And it's not the easiest to read. There's a lot in it. But there's one section in it where he goes into great detail for priests about how to give homilies. Now, you'd swear there was a problem with the quality of homilies in this country. Thankfully, even the priests are laughing at this. but in that section, in my view, he summarizes his entire approach. Because how he tells us to give a homily is actually how he's telling us to evangelize as church. Okay? So let me just detail that section with you for a few minutes, okay? He says, a beautiful homily, a genuine sermon, must begin with the first proclamation, begin with the proclamation of salvation. There is nothing more solid, deep, and sure than this proclamation. Then you have to do catechesis. Then you can draw even a moral consequence. But the proclamation of the saving love of God comes before moral and religious imperatives. Today it seems that the opposite order is prevailing. Now let me just take a few moments with that paragraph. A beautiful homily. And he talks about beauty. The word beauty is mentioned a lot in Evangelii Gaudium. Almost not quite as much as joy, but it's mentioned a lot. A genuine sermon must begin with the first proclamation, with the proclamation of salvation. Can we kill that boiler? Because it's going to... Thank you. I just point to the finger and it stops. This is great, great sense of power. begin with the first proclamation. Begin with the proclamation of salvation. In other words, begin with the good news. Not with the bad news, but begin... Where is the good news? So when a priest first approaches a text to preach on a Sunday morning, say, where's the good news for the people of God in this text? What's the good news? The saving news, the healing news, the compassionate news. But Pope Francis is in Evangelii Gaudium saying, that's not just for a homily. That's in every single way we approach people, we relate to people, we respond to people as Christians. The first thing we do is, what good news do I have for these people? What saving news, healing news, news that renders them whole as people, do we have for them? Begin with the proclamation. The proclamation, again, when we hear that, we think of that lovely text, where Jesus tells the disciples of John the Baptist, go and tell them what you see. The blind hear, the blind see, the deaf hear, the dumb speak, the poor have the good news preached to them. That's the first proclamation. What renders people whole again? Begin with that. Then you can do the catechesis. Then you can draw a moral consequence. Then you can say, if this is how God loves you, if this is how God heals you, if this is how God gives you his mercy and compassion, if this is how God forgives you, Well, what are you going to do about it? What is the only appropriate way to respond to that good news? What is the meaning of this for your life? The imperatives follow. In other words, what we are to do. Do you remember your grammar? Because young students don't know their grammar anymore. I can tell you that from college, but I'm sure you do. The imperative is the second case. It's telling you what to do. But the telling people what to do follows the experience of being enabled to do it because of God's love. And that's really at the heart of Pope Francis's approach. He's saying there's no point in telling people to do things if they haven't first been enabled to do these things by knowing God's, the cost of God's love, the price of God's love, the sacrifice that God has undertaken in Jesus Christ for our lives. Knowing and experiencing the joy that that gives us enables us to make whatever sacrifices we have to make to live our lives in a particular kind of way. That's at the heart of Evangelii Gaudium, and it's the heart of Pope Francis's approach. As we'll see in a moment, it's actually, if you read his biography carefully, it's the story of his own life. He has experienced himself the mercy and the freeing gaze of Christ in his own life. And this has enabled him to love in this way. And interesting, in case I forget to say it, anybody who meets Pope Francis face to face, and I only saw him along with 4 million others on the beach in Copacabana, but anybody who has got close to Pope Francis, I'm sure Bishop Kevin can say this, that he has this look, this gaze that just seems to, he's present to you in a very particular kind of way. Anyway, so this is the first thing. Then just the next paragraph. He says, we cannot only insist on, he's not saying we don't insist on, but we cannot insist only on issues, for example, related to abortion, gay marriage, use of contraception, whatever else. This is not possible. I have not spoken about much about these things, and I've been reprimanded for that. And indeed, this has happened during the Synod in a way. People are concerned that these issues are not being, the Church's teaching on these issues are not sufficiently underscored or underlined. But when we speak, he says we have to talk about them in a context. So he's not saying we don't speak about difficult moral issues, but there's no point in speaking about them if people don't know, first of all, the love of God that gives the Church's teaching on these matters a context. So again, back to the image of the field hospital that we're on emergency footing in the Church at the moment. Evangelization is key, mission is key. Concentrate on helping people to understand the mercy and the love of God, and then these other things follow. But that's where you begin, and that's where you put your energy. So again, just to continue, these are all in the same paragraphs of Evangelii Gaudium. The thing that the Church needs today is the ability to heal wounds and to warm the hearts of the faithful. It needs nearness, proximity. I see the Church, here it is, as a field hospital after battle. It's useless to ask a seriously injured person if he has high cholesterol and about the level of his blood sugars. You have to heal his wounds. Then we can talk about everything else. Heal the wounds, and you have to start from the ground up. You start where the person is at. And just the next one is important here too. Tell me, for example, when God looks at a gay person, does he endorse the existence of this person with love or reject and condemn this person? We must always consider the person. Here we enter into the mystery of the human being. In life, God accompanies persons, and we must accompany them, starting from their situation. It is necessary to accompany them with mercy. Start from the ground up. Start from their situation. What's been happening all week at the Synod in Rome, if I may be so bold to try to summarize it in my view, is a tension between realities from the peripheries and doctrine and teaching and truth as articulated in these from the center. It's not between truth and something else. It's truth and truth, because the realities at the peripheries are true as well. And then we have our teaching. And how do we hold these together? That's been the dialogue. And Pope Francis has created deliberately created a space where the realities from the peripheries can be spoken about. Every session of the Synod started with a married couple, just because that didn't seem to be picked up by the media. They were the first to speak, and that was a change in process. But Pope Francis says, start from the situation where people are at. Understand that. And another key word, and it's a word I think we will see in the final document that comes out this evening, is the word accompany. It's three times in that sentence. God accompanies persons, and we must accompany them. It is necessary to accompany them with mercy. Now, if you said to me, I'm going for a walk, and I say, Asher, I'll accompany you, it's not big. It's no big deal, is it? That's not the kind of accompany that Pope Francis is speaking about. When he says accompany people, he means really to journey with them, to be with them in their, to literally have compassion, which means to suffer with, to be a companion. A company, companion, is somebody with whom you eat bread. You share their life, you share their lot. That's what Pope Francis is saying here. Companionship, compassion, journey with. Walk in their shoes. Now, it's not just Pope Francis saying this. This is very much, as I say again, in the documents of a Parousia. And what Pope Francis is saying is the world church has, each part of the world church has gifts to give to each other. It's not just the European church giving to the rest of it. Again, a new feature of Evangelii Gaudium is that bishops' conferences from around the world are cited and quoted, from Oceania to Latin America. So different parts of the church have gifts to give to the whole. But this idea of journeying with accompaniment is a key theme in Evangelii Gaudium, a key theme for Pope Francis. So in a few moments, you will be asked to consider, what does it mean to have a missionary option in the Diocese of Elphin? And you're going to say, my God, what does he mean by a missionary option? But it means, how do we do this? How do we actually accompany people? How do we go to the peripheries, embrace those who are on the edges? How do we actually be more like a MASH than the Blackrock Clinic as a diocese? That's really what we're being asked to consider, to break it down into ordinary terms. So Pope Francis talks about becoming or being in a missionary key, this putting the mission foremost or uppermost, this idea again of a special situation, we're in an emergency situation we're in. I'm sure many of you hear a musical that Colette accompanied us beautifully with music there earlier. You know how you can change the key of a piece in music? Maybe it's too low or too high. It has to be transposed into a different key. What Pope Francis is saying at the moment, we transpose everything into a missionary key. When we adopt a pastoral goal and a missionary style, which would actually reach everyone without exception or exclusion, the message has to concentrate on the essentials, on what is most beautiful, most grand, and most appealing, and at the same time, most necessary. So again, if we're going to take on a missionary option in the church, one of the questions you have to ask yourselves is, what is most essential in our church? What is most beautiful? What is most grand and most appealing, and at the same time, most necessary in the Diocese of Elphin, because that's the church we're in at the moment, in the Irish church? What falls under these headings? I'm nearly finished, okay? His approach, humility. Utter humility and respect before the complexity of the situations people find themselves in. We saw that right from the word go. And these gestures are not calculated, they're spontaneous on his part. This is the way the man is. And I'm sure many of us are, please God, we all are in our own way. But he recognizes the complexity of the situations people find themselves in. One of the cardinals, well, he was a bishop, he became a cardinal afterwards, at the last synod, who spoke most powerfully about the need for humility and respect was Cardinal Tagle of Manila, of the Philippines. And the Filipino church, I suppose, has its own particular trials. One of the other, Archbishop Villegas, said, you can preach to people whose stomachs are empty. He said, it's possible, but only if the stomach of the preacher is as empty as those to whom he's preaching. Interesting point. Recognizing the situations in which people are in. And then the other point, it's like the one about accompaniment, is enabling people to grow, this process of growth. Recognizing we're not all fully grown. Whatever age we're at, whatever stage we're at, to be alive is still to be growing. Or decaying, actually. We have a choice. We have responsibility that we are actually growing spiritually. But that's happening for us. Perhaps the most challenging and disturbing aspect of Pope Francis's message is to accept the gift of God's mercy for ourselves. That's perhaps the most challenging and most disturbing thing. Do I actually allow myself to be touched by the mercy of God? To heal those dark and damaged parts of my life that maybe I've even cut myself out of, but can still be doing damage to myself and to others? Do I actually open my own heart to the mercy of God? That's, I think, the most challenging aspect of this. In some respects, if we allow that to happen, everything else follows. And we will actually understand that we can be nothing else but missionary. Because we will want to share the joy of that experience with others. It'll happen spontaneously. We won't have to be calculating about it. It'll be just our way of being in the world, because this will have touched our own hearts and reached into our own hearts. I'm almost finished, but I do want to end this part of the presentation. If we could just kill the lights in the room for a moment. Are they off? They're off. Okay, well, we can't do anything about the light of the sun, and we wouldn't want to. This is unfortunately difficult to pick it up, but this is Pope Francis's favourite painting. It's a painting by Caravaggio, and it's called The Call of Matthew. Matthew was, as you know, a tax collector, a disciple, became one of the apostles. But Caravaggio, the famous artist, painted this painting, which is on the wall, hanging on the wall of the Church of St. Louis of France in Rome. And that church was near where Pope Francis used to stay on his very rare visits to Rome. He was not a fan of frequent travel to Rome. And this painting was hanging on the wall. He used to go over there and he'd pray. And he talks about this painting in an interview he gave shortly after he was elected. And it's the gaze of Christ and Matthew looking back, saying, the finger is pointing, saying, "Who? Me? 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 Is it me you're talking to?" You know, and this is actually how Pope Francis tells the story in Civiltà Cattolica. And that sense of the wanting to resist, but not being able to resist. Knowing that responding will have a price, but knowing it was the right thing to do, the call of Matthew. And so Pope Francis says that we experience two things together. We experience the call, and at the same moment we experience the grace to respond to that call. At the same moment as we experience the demand of the gospel in our lives, whatever that might be, we experience the mercy and the love that enables us to respond to it. And he tries to capture this in his episcopal motto, just the next slide. Miserande atque elegendo. He had this as his motto as a bishop, and he's kept it as pope. By having mercy, by choosing him. And they're both kind of, the language is that continuous language. By having mercy, by choosing him. So in that gaze of Christ, we experience two things at the same time. We experience mercy, forgiveness, healing, and love. And we experience the call or the demand to respond. The challenge he puts before us, Pope Francis puts before each one of us, is to allow ourselves to experience God's mercy, and then to respond with generosity to the demand of the gospel. And when we do, the fruit of that is joy. Joy is, for Pope Francis, and it's used nearly 100 times, the word is used in Evangelii Gaudium, and the word is in the title, the joy of the gospel. Joy for Pope Francis is both what we bring to others and what we get out of the act of bringing the gospel to others. Joy, it's out of joy we communicate the gospel, and joy is what results from communicating the gospel. So that is just an attempt to give you where I believe Pope Francis is leading us, calling us, beckoning us. It's quite a challenging demand. When I read Evangelii Gaudium the first time, I said, "This, I'm not where I was before I read this." It's a demand. It's an invitation and a demand. But hold the two together, because with the invitation comes the mercy and the grace and the love that enables us to respond. Thank you very much.